For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, now reopened for in-store shopping on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 till 5, Saturdays from 10 to 4. And don't forget your mask. And you can still shop online at jackanddrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very, very excited that our morning show can begin with one of America's most beloved and highly respected nature writers. His name is Ted Williams, and he has written for many, many years for Audubon Magazine and for many other outlets as well. Is a very compelling and persuasive voice on behalf of the natural world and its inhabitants, and has just written a lovely book that was actually, I believe, released earlier this year to help celebrate the 50th anniversary of the first Earth Day. This is called Earth Almanac, and in it we are treated to more than 200 short essays by Ted Williams, celebrating all kinds of different facets of the natural world around us. And he does so by taking us through the seasons. And it is a beautifully written book. And I am so glad that I got to experience it, to read it, and I'm so glad that we get to talk about it now. The book is published by Story Publishing. Again, it's The Earth Almanac by Ted Williams. Ted Williams, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good to be with you, Greg.
Take us, first of all, back to the beginning for you in terms of your own interest in the natural world. How did that come about? What ignited that interest for you?
Well, when I was a child, I was taken fishing with my grandfather and uncle, and I started noticing other things while fishing, and it just blossomed from that. I went to work for the Division of Fish and Game in Massachusetts in 1970. And worked in their magazine, Mass Wildlife. And since then, I've just been writing strictly about fish and wildlife and conservation. And since Earth Day, we've made a lot of progress that doesn't get much reported. I'm old enough to remember how bad it was in the 70s and 60s when we were spraying DDT around. And since then, we've seen a tremendous recovery in all kinds of species. I was reminded about that while writing the book. You pay careful attention when you read the book to the many species that have recovered from desperate trouble and continue to do well, or at least hold their own in a world in which general assumption is that everything has gone to hell. Even now, as I reread the manuscript, I find good news. And it's remarkably uplifting. These victories are more than isolated events. They result from ways of thinking, new ways to respond to wildlife emergencies. Together, they prove that humans can undo damage they've done and restore the planet. What's more, they indicate that humans can prove themselves to be successful species by living in harmony with their own habitat and other life forms. saved the gray whale, the striped bass, the bluebird, the loon, bald eagle. We never saw bald eagles or bluebirds when I was a child, and now we see it a lot.
Something else you write about in the preface is about how when you do this kind of writing that is shared in your Earth Almanac, it is, in a sense, something of a retreat for you from a lot of the other kind of writing that you do as an investigative environmental reporter. Tell us more about the kind of blessed relief that this kind of writing represents for you versus what unfortunately need to occupy quite a lot of your time and attention.
Right. Most of my articles have been muckraking, reporting bad news, things we need to fix. And it does get depressing. So this was a real relief to spend a week on these essays. And I tried to avoid discouraging news and emphasize the good stuff, because it doesn't get reported a lot of times. Environmental groups are great, but they do fundraising, and they have to report the bad stuff so that they can get funds. And the good news gets ignored lots of times.
Before we explore a little more specifically about the book, since its publication coincides with the 50th Earth Day earlier this year, I wonder if you could just share any recollections you have about when they first created this thing called Earth Day, if you have vivid recollections of that first Earth Day, or at the beginning, was it maybe not all that big a deal and maybe something that people had no idea would be going on a half century later? And I also wonder how you yourself have tended to celebrate Earth Day over the years.
Well, it was a huge deal for the first two or three or four years. And like everything else, it kind of faded away. But it's still celebrated, and we have different perspectives now on Earth Day. When the first Earth Day came out, we were going to end the pollution in 10 years. Well, that, of course, was impossible, but we made huge advances, and we didn't have a Clean Air Act, we didn't have ESA, we didn't have Clean Water Act. All these things happened since Earth Day, and I'm sure people remember the Cuyahoga River catching on fire. Now it has a run of wild steelhead trout.
I do appreciate the fact that this book is a celebration of so much of what has gone right. You write at the end of your preface, "From the outset, I was convinced that this column wasn't the place for calls to action. A straight diet of exposés and activism is a prescription for burnout. I wanted the Earth Almanac column to be a refuge, not just for myself, for my readers." We're speaking with Ted Williams about his book called Earth Almanac, A Year of Witnessing the Wild, From the Call of the Loon to the Journey of the Gray Whale. We have, of course, the season of winter right around the corner, and I appreciate the words with which this section of the book begins. The dead of winter is an oxymoron. Never is winter dead. It only looks that way to those who don't get out into it. Tell us more about some of the intriguing ways in which winter is not nearly as lifeless as it might appear at a careless glance.
Well, you have to look for the little things. One of my essays was called Jumping Jimmies, and they're the springtails, these ancient wingless snow fleas that live under the snow. And when it warms up a little bit, they burrow up to the surface. They're 3 million years old, and they're called springtails. And they look like somebody had dumped a huge shaker of pepper on top of the snow. And if you look carefully, you can see them jumping around a little bit. That's just one of the things you can see in winter.
By the way, when you describe those to us in that essay, I remember you say they are smaller than chocolate sprinkles, smaller even than coffee grounds. And, of course, it's exactly the kind of thing that we are apt to miss altogether.
Exactly right. And the other thing is look for the prints of raptor wings on snow where they've attempted or succeeded in catching rodents. They'll make a huge imprint, snow angels. Just one of the many things, fungus brackets on trees, artist fungi. All these type of things are there in the winter to observe and celebrate.
I was really surprised in this section of the book to read that there is such a thing as winter butterflies. And I suppose winter is one of those seasons that yields a whole lot of surprises if we know where to look for them.
Right. The butterflies, the angle wings and morning cloaks, they will actually hibernate under dead leaves. It's a good reason not to rake up all your dead leaves. And on warm winter days, you can actually see some of them flying around. One species is called a question mark because it has something that looks like a question mark on its wing. Another is a comma because it looks like it has a comma on its wing. And the morning cloak is a large, beautiful black butterfly with yellow fringe that looks like a morning cloak.
Hmm. I really loved the description that you gave of a bird that we see a lot of here in Wisconsin, and particularly during the winter, namely the cardinal. And you obviously have a tremendous fondness for the beautiful song of the cardinal. Tell us more about that.
Well, the cardinals, like a lot of species, we didn't have cardinals in New England, and probably out your way either. They moved up maybe 40 years ago. Now they're ubiquitous everywhere. And they have a cool song and cool call, pretty, and it's unmistakable. Sometimes in the spring, people get upset because they look like they have mange. They have no feathers on their head, but this is a normal molting phenomena.
Hmm. When you start writing about the season of spring, which we will, of course, look forward to in a few months, you write, "Spring is a grand time for all who love nature and want to learn more about it, but it can be a difficult and confusing time because everything happens at once." Tell us more about what you are describing there.
Well, it's kind of an overkill. Everything is happening. The bird song, the birds are arriving, different species, wildflowers are blooming, cowslip, trout lilies, snakes are freshly undenned. The morning cloak butterflies that I mentioned a minute ago come out of hibernation. They sail around at head level and sip sap from birch trees. Budding hardwoods, flush of warblers. Very confusing to learn all their songs. You're not going to see them because they're so quick up in the treetops. You have to learn their songs. For some of us who are older, you lose some of the high-pitched vocalizations. But, you know, you make an effort. And so it is, it's kind of a sensory overload, but a good one.
Absolutely, in the best sense of the word.
All right.
I appreciate what you have to say about summer. That section begins, "Summer is a season when nature slows down and draws her breath." But you also point out, and quite rightly, that that for many species, summer is a really challenging time. And one of the most fascinating things to observe is the way in which the world's creatures try to find ways to sustain themselves through difficult summers.
Right. One of my favorite fish is the brook trout, and they're in trouble from a lot of things, pollution and culverts that don't allow migration upstream. But they are stressed naturally in summer because the water warms up. They're cold water fish, and you have sometimes droughts, and they're just kind of sweating it out in little pools, hovering over springs, in big schools, and vulnerable to predators. So it's a tough time for a lot of these species.
One of the things that I found especially amusing was one of the essays in which you talk a little bit about the sexual practices of the porcupine, and in particular something that happens with the quills of a porcupine, which allow the mother porcupine to give birth without the sort of agony that we might assume would be part of it.
One would think that it would be a very painful birth, but it's not, because the quills are soft as fur, and then they harden within a few hours. And an adult porcupine has 30,000 quills easily detached, and they don't like to use them, but they will if they start posturing. Keep your distance and tell your dog to do the same.
In our last minute or so, I want to give you an opportunity to describe what would maybe be the most beautiful or wondrous thing you have ever observed in the wild in your many years of work.
Boy, that's hard to say, but I think that maybe the resurgence of bluebirds. When I was a kid, we didn't see them. They were hit hard by DDT and competition from starlings and house sparrows, which are alien invasive species, also nested in cavities. And DDT was basically banned, and the public got into bluebird boxes, and there was a huge resurgence. Now we have them a lot. We put up boxes in our field and have two or three broods a year. And bluebirds have changed their habits. They forget to fly south now. They hang around all winter, eating winter berries, and we feed them mealworms and winter berries. It's hard to wean them from the winter berries to the mealworms, but we do that by adding mealworms to a dish of winter berries, and it's they're fun to watch. They're gorgeous birds, and they were virtually endangered, and now they're doing very well. And because of that, tree swallows are doing much better, because the tree swallows use the bird box, the bluebird boxes as well, and the holes are too small to emit starlings.
Well, one of many, shall we call them, success stories celebrated in this lovely book called Earth Almanac, with beautiful illustrations by John Burgoyne and the text by Ted Williams. This is published by Story Publishing. Ted Williams, thank you so much for giving the world this lovely book, and best wishes to you.
Thank you. And I should add that there's another book also by the name of Earth Almanac that just happened to come out at the same time. It's a good book by Ken Kiefer, but his book is $24.95 and mine is $16.95.
There you go. A bargain, and a beautiful bargain it is. Ted Williams, thank you so much. Best wishes to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two will be coming up in just a moment. We want to remind you that the Morning Show is available to you in podcast format with a different Morning Show 7 days a week. And in many cases, the podcast version of the Morning Show can include interviews in their unabridged form. You can subscribe to the Morning Show podcast via all of the major podcast providers, including
Google Podcast, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. Be sure to look for the proper title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. Part two of today's morning show features a morning show interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2016. I have had the pleasure on a couple of previous occasions of speaking with someone who is probably one of the smartest human beings on the planet and certainly one of its most gifted writers. I'm talking about Leonard Mlodinow. And we have spoken, I believe, twice before on the morning show, including on one occasion when we talked about an extraordinary book called The Grand Design, which Dr. Mlodinow co-wrote with Stephen Hawking. We also spoke about his book called, an award-winning bestseller called Subliminal. His latest book, in many respects, may be the most extraordinary yet, a book called The Upright Thinkers, The Human Journey from Living in Trees to Understanding the Cosmos. In this book, Dr. Mlodinow is, in a sense, attempting the near impossible by trying to sketch for us, in one single book, our journey as human beings from relatively primitive beings living in trees, gathering and foraging, to the human beings that we are today, capable of amazing intellectual thought and technological innovation. How did we get from there to here? And where are we headed from here? And these are, of course, exceptionally immense questions of huge scope. And yet I think the author's done an exceptionally impressive job of taking us on such an extraordinary journey. And I really feel privileged to have this opportunity to speak with Leonard Mlodinow again about his book, The Upright Thinkers, The Human Journey from Living in Trees to Understanding the Cosmos, which is published by Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. Leonard Mlodinow, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg. Really nice to be here.
I really appreciate this. I want to ask you, I mean, we have so many questions of substance to deal with, and I don't want to take too much time with this kind of preliminary bit of fluff, but I want to ask you about the fact that although this book deals with such weighty matters, such huge and complex questions, you really inject quite a lot of humor along the way in this book of otherwise tremendous substance. I just wonder how much of that is a conscious effort on your part to, in a sense, maybe leaven such intimidating, intellectually rigorous work with a dash of humor? Or is that just kind of a natural outflow of who you are as a person?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of both. My aim in writing the book was to make it entertaining, readable, and to present the human journey in a manner that's more like a story than a book about science. And so in places I felt like there was a place to add humor, I would do that. Other times it just came to me. You know, years ago I spent some time writing for television. I wrote for shows that you might expect from a scientist, like Star Trek: The Next Generation, MacGyver. But I also wrote for some comedies. The old show Night Court. I wrote for the comic Gary Shandling. So in my younger days, I used to have a sense of humor, and every once in a while, a little taste of that comes back.
Well, and as you write in the prologue to the book, in the wrong hands, science can be famously boring. And so I applaud you for writing a book like this and having it not only be really interesting, but also never, ever boring. The overall construction of the book says a lot about this intriguing human journey on which you take us. The fact that the opening section of the book covers a certain span of human history,
the second and third sections, very different spans of history or time as well. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about, the sort of lopsided chronological framework of this book.
Well, excuse me, our advancement is exponential, which means that, well, in the most general terms, that the rate at which we're learning and advancing in our culture is constantly accelerating. And so the beginning of the book starts with our drive to know, the development of curiosity in the human brain. I start even before, you know, when we lived, before we settled down, when we lived in the African savannah, and I talk about how, what drove us to form the first settlements, and those were spiritual questions, religious issues. And through the development of reading and arithmetic and why we developed those, which were for government and bureaucracy, not very exciting purposes, but we eventually put them to great use. But all that journey took millions of years to go from being an ape to what we call a modern human, and then it took many tens of thousands of years to settle down, and then thousands of years to develop the city. So that's all the first part of the book. It's bringing us from living in the savannah to civilization, and the birth of reason and philosophy. And then the second part of the book talks about how we develop the ideas and the approach of modern science. So it's really not so much the subject matter of science, but how we learn to learn about the universe. And then I go through the development of the major sciences, chemistry, physics, and biology, and all the crazy people who were responsible for getting those off the ground. And that journey took hundreds and hundreds of years. And then the final journey, what really started about 100 years ago, and it's just a matter of decades, and that's where we made the next great leap, which was from understanding the macroscopic world, the world that we see and that we experience, to understand the invisible, hidden world of the atom and what's beyond our senses. And due to some technologies that evolved in the late 19th century, we started to be able to probe that. And we found that the laws that we had thought applied to the world, that apply to the world that we feel and see and smell, don't really work on that level, and we had to have a whole new set of laws. That was the so-called quantum revolution, and that's what really that was a big jump in our own thinking, to be able to accept that things behave in bizarre ways and that there was a hidden world. But it's what led to our modern society, to everything that defines us today, to, you know, telephones, cable TV, computers, lasers, medical technology. I mean, even what we're learning about the genes today would not be possible without the technologies of quantum theory. So really that was a kind of revolution that people don't think about too much, but it was a huge revolution in the way humans live.
I appreciated all the information packed into the second chapter of the book, which is called Curiosity, which not only explains how maybe uniquely human curiosity emerged, but also really traces the development of what occurred before the emergence of Homo sapiens. I especially appreciated a kind of a wonderful moment when you are talking about the discovery of this skeleton of someone who came to be known as Lucy, one of the first examples of what was then a newly discovered species of Australopithecus. And as you're explaining the significance of Lucy and her peers, shall we say, you create this wonderful image of us to help us understand sort of the sweep of human development, in which you ask us to imagine living in a house and your mother next door and so on. I want you to trace out that picture that you create. It is so wonderful, and it really helps us understand the sprawling sense of time that we're dealing with here in terms of the emergence of human beings.
Yeah, well, imagine if you live in a house and your mother's next door, as you said, and then next door to that is her mother, and next door to that is her mother, and so on. So then that street really contains all the generations of of our human heritage. So the question is, as you travel down the street, you're traveling backwards in time, and how far do you have to go to find Lucy? Well, Lucy is about 100,000 generations, so you have to go 100,000 houses. It's quite a drive.
You suggest maybe about 4,000 miles.
Yes, 4,000 miles to reach Lucy. So that tells you as you're traveling backward in time. I was trying to give an image that showed how far we've traveled from her, you know, to us. And you know, if you go back to what I was talking about, say the quantum revolution, that would have been, I guess, about, you know, five houses down. So it's still on your same block. So it's an interesting way to get a feeling for our progress and really the exponential growth of our progress, the exponential speed up.
Tell us about the emergence of someone who is known in a sense as erect man and what that signifies in our development.
Well, the book is called, the subtitle of the book is The Human Journey from Living in the Trees to Understanding the Cosmos. And, you know, erect man was the human being that first stood up and stood straight. And that was a huge step for us because of two things. One is that it allowed us to look outside at the world and to get a really more global picture of the environment. And that sounds almost trivial, but do you remember when you first started driving? I don't know if your teacher told you this, but they used to say, get the big picture. You know, when you're
right.
Driving the car, don't just stare at the guy's tail in front of you, and then you'll end up hitting him. But look ahead and see, get a perspective of what's going on. And that was really very important, that people could, instead of looking down at the ground, could look ahead and get look around them and get a feeling for what the world looks like. And the other thing that it did was it freed up our hands to hold things and to build things. And so that was really a huge step in our development, even though it's rather an unsung step.
Exactly. And so we start developing things like stone choppers and much later arrows and, of course, eventually airplanes and so on. You make a really interesting observation in this chapter that I want you to just say a word about. Humans, at one point you write, humans seem to have a certain built-in understanding of the physical world, a sophisticated intuitive feeling for the environment that complements our built-in curiosity, and is far more developed in humans than in other species. You write this after telling us about a modern-day experiment involving infants, and which is pretty interesting, but I want you to say a word about how this was true even back in the time of Homo erectus and the evidence that from our earliest roots we have been set apart from others in the animal kingdom by this intuitive understanding of the world around us.
Well, what's interesting is that if you take young infants, say 6 months old, and infants who really haven't had much of a chance to explore the world, they don't walk yet, you can do experiments with them where you show them physics situations, cylinders rolling, colliding with each other, going up and down inclined planes, situations that they haven't really had any or much experience with and don't have the brain to really analyze. But you can, if you're clever, you can understand what their understanding is of those situations. And that's because infants will behave differently when they're surprised by something than when they're viewing something that they see as normal. So if something surprises them, they'll stare at it. And otherwise, their eyes tend to dart around a lot. They look around. So scientists measure the eye movements of infants as they're watching certain physics collisions. And what they found is that even very, very young children who have no experience of the world seem to understand Newton's law. So if a billiard ball collides with another billiard ball and doesn't bounce off in the way that it should based on the normal laws of nature, the child will be surprised. So that shows that we seem to be born with some certain innate sense of how the Earth works. And if you look back at the tools and the developments of the precursors to humans, we see that reflects an understanding that other animals don't seem to have of how the laws of physics work. So what's interesting about that to me is that, you know, we say that Isaac Newton is one of the main people responsible for inventing the laws of physics, but really Isaac Newton did was describe what everybody already knows, but put it into a mathematical form. And the quantum revolution was a huge leap, because that was where humanity went beyond that. So we went beyond anything that is part of our experience or of our, you know, innate nature, and started to probe a whole other universe.
Hmm. You help us understand a very different theory about the emergence of what we might collectively call culture, and the fact that culture maybe did not emerge, as had long been presumed, out of sort of practical necessity of matters of survival, people coming together for that reason, but actually coming together more for mental and spiritual reasons, that is when we first began to take some of these extraordinary steps. And the discovery of a location in southeastern Turkey, a very, very ancient structure, maybe the world's oldest known church, is some indication of this.
Well, in school, you know, you learn about something called the agricultural revolution, where they teach you that about 10,000 years ago, people settled down, gave up the nomadic life in order to grow crops and have a better life. And that is actually totally wrong. And like many stories that I've learned as I was doing the research for this book, it's a myth. And recent science shows that it wasn't that way at all. We can study the remains of early peoples who were either nomads or the first agricultural humans. And we can see from their bones that the nomads were in better health and had better nutrition than those who settled down, and had, in general, skeletons that were in better shape. Agriculture is extremely difficult, and scientists who study the history of agriculture know that, you know, without modern machines, agriculture is a punishing occupation. And so it doesn't seem that that's really true, that we settled down for that reason. But on the other hand, what we've found recently is that there are ruins from about that time of, as you said, structures that seem to be the first churches. And these were places that people visited at first from far, far and wide, and they didn't live near there, but they would be wanderers, and they would gather there periodically, and they would have some sorts of ceremony, and we find the remains there. And then eventually, when we find the first settlements, we found that there are signs of spiritual and cultural artifacts there. For instance, the way people treated their dead, they would bury their families under their homes, and they seem to also form certain objects with their skeletons. And so that we're not quite sure what they were doing, but it seemed to be some kind of spiritual enterprise. And yet in those first villages, they weren't really cities as we define them today, because there was no specialization of labor. They were just families where everyone did everything for themselves, but they lived together, and people question why they did, and it seems to be for spiritual reasons. And that didn't develop into real cities for thousands of years. So it seemed that around 10,000 years ago, what happened was people started asking questions about what is life, what is death, and they settled down so they could be together and they could worship together and ask those questions. And that's what really formed the roots of science that came later.
Hmm. One of the things you say about us, that is human beings versus other animal species on Earth, is that one human mind can influence the thoughts of another in a very complex and nuanced manner. And, of course, that comes because of our unique capacity for language. And I love the way that you trace the significance of that through the development of villages and cities and what the creation of cities meant then in terms of creating things like government and means of cooperation on a scale never seen before. We ultimately take ourselves to the second portion of your book, which which is involved with the emergence of reason and ultimately of the sciences. And it seems to me that as much as anything, this portion of the book is meant, among other things, to dispel us of a myth that the propulsion of scientific discovery is mostly due to certain isolated geniuses and visionaries. And you really call that into question as being a real serious misunderstanding of how science emerged and of how scientific breakthroughs occurred. Explain how this, on the one hand, can be a story of revolutionaries and yet not individuals creating this, in a sense, on their own.
Well, again, there are a lot of myths of how certain discoveries were made. Sort of the story that you normally hear of science is something like the Hollywood version of people's lives. You know, it's based on a true story or it's inspired by a true story, but it's not the real story. And I suppose those myths grew up so that we have heroes and we condense time and space and it's more interesting to tell the story of a discovery that happens in one instant than something that took a lifetime to come to. But the reality is that scientists are passionate and confused people who are groping in the dark, who are searching, who are explorers, detectives, and they find clues. They don't understand them. They, you know, eventually piece things together, come to a story or a conclusion that makes some sense, but they probably don't, in most cases, understand it themselves even then. And it takes later generations to even work out the consequences of what most scientists discover. So, for instance, take Newton. He didn't come to his theory by watching an apple fall. He didn't come to his great theories that one summer, you know, where he spent the year where he spent where there was a plague and he was hiding out at his mother's farm. He started on his journey then, but it took him decades to work out the consequences of the ideas that he had then. And he, along the way, did many crazy things that today we would think he was a nut. He looked in the Bible for signs, codes about when the world's going to end. He spent a lot of time in alchemy. He did a lot of things that went nowhere that no one talks about. Interspersed with the stuff that he did that went somewhere, because he wasn't just a genius who saw things clearly and wrote it all down and revolutionized the world. He was someone who spent decades investigating all sorts of blind alleys with great energy and fervor and eventually discovered some things that were true.
Yeah. As you write at one point, this is actually when you're talking about Galileo, but it applies to Newton as well, I think. We tend to think of the development of science as a series of discoveries, each leading to the next through the efforts of some solitary intellectual giant with a clear and extraordinary vision. But the vision of the great discoverers of intellectual history is often more muddled than clear, and their accomplishments more indebted to their friends and colleagues and luck than the legends show, and that the discoverers themselves often wish to admit. And, of course, such understanding is not going to be the grist of Hollywood scripts, but fortunately that's not what we're talking about here today. Could you just say a quick word about the way in which all of us should feel a sense of indebtedness to Isaac Newton? At one point you say, today we all reason like Newtonians in all kinds of things that we say on a day-to-day basis. Can you just quickly explain what you're talking about there?
Well, I appreciate your energy in this interview, and I don't want to break the momentum.
Right.
But many of the words and terms that we use come directly from Newton's ideas. And even to say that you have the potential to accomplish great energy, I mean, it's just really it's infused the way we think. We talk about everything from sports to business to our personal lives. is all framed in the concepts that Newton invented that he saw operating in the world around him. And the idea that the world operates according to strict laws, that one thing causes another, really wasn't that ingrained at all into people's thinking until Newton came along, and then that's why they sometimes call his ideas the mechanical universe, the clockwork universe, because after Newton, everyone in all kinds of science, not just in physics, but in chemistry and biology, they started to look at the world as running like a clockwork, and everything affecting everything else, and things happening for good reason according to natural law. And that was a huge change, because before that, people believed in the approach of Aristotle, which was that everything happens for a purpose. It's more of a religious view of the world, rather than because that things happening because of following laws.
You ultimately, of course, take us through the discovery of the cell, the discovery of the atom, and quantum physics and string theory and all of the stuff that a show like The Big Bang Theory sort of introduces to us. You really help us understand some of the amazing breakthroughs. You end your book, however, or at least before the epilogue, with a personal moment involving your own father and the stroke he suffered towards the very end of his life. And I'm struck by the fact that you would inject such a personal note in this particular book. You do it beautifully. Explain why that moment is here.
Well, my father had just a seventh grade education and didn't understand or ever learn any science, but he was very interested in how the universe works, in particular because he wanted to know what is our place in the world. And, you know, he went through the Holocaust and saw horrible things happen and experienced great horrors, and he was trying to put it all together. And when I was first learning science, I had a lot of discussions on that point with him and a lot of late night, talks about what it all means. And so even back then, I thought that one day I would write a book like this explaining the meaning of science and how we came to know what we know and what it says about us as people. And, you know, he's long gone and it's decades later, but I finally wrote the book, and interspersed in the book, I have a few snippets of stories that he told me that I think were very relevant.
Well,
and I have a few snippets of stories that he told me that were very relevant to this. Yeah. And so in the end, I end with his end and the talk that we had about the nature of the universe, shortly before he died.
Mm. I love that. And I love a lot of personal touches that are part of this. It just makes the book all the more compelling. Again, it's called The Upright Thinkers, The Human Journey from Living in Trees to Understanding the Cosmos, published by Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House, the author, Leonard Mlodina. Leonard Mlodina, congratulations on writing such a superb book. I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak with you about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Monday on The Morning Show, my interview with Darren Strauss, the author of The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story, a fascinating novel with the great Lucille Ball herself as one of the central characters, and a novel that creates the interesting possibility that Darren Strauss's grandfather had actually a marital affair with Lucille Ball. It sounds strange, but it's actually a marvelously crafted book. And in the novel, we really learn a lot about Lucille Ball and her life. On Tuesday, Kenosha Unified's Holly Stanfield, who, of course, directs the musical theater productions for Kenosha Unified. We're going to find out from her about how the school district is going to continue to mount musical theater productions even during the restrictions of COVID-19. On Wednesday, we're going to be hearing about how the Kenosha Symphony will be performing a concert next weekend at the Kemper Center. And we'll also be